Good evening. This is Mae Brussel. The program emanates from KAZU FM in Pacific Grove, California. It's called World Watchers, and this is program number 686, January the 28th, 1985. At the beginning of this year, just about a month ago, I was having a fit. Couldn't get enough writing done, too many telephone calls, too many letters. I'll give you a progress report of what's happened in the last month. I appreciate the phone calls being cut down. The CNN cable news changed in our area. I live in a remote area up on a hill. It was cut off from our area, and we get U.S., which I don't watch. So I have saved myself about an hour and a half a day or 2 hours where I would flick on the news, watch Freeman Reports, Crossfire. And so I've had that period to study and read or do whatever I wanted. That saved 2 hours a day in addition to cutting the telephone calls and the mail. My car stereo tape deck has been broken since Thanksgiving. It was sent down to San Diego to be fixed. I've had 2 months in the car with absolute quiet, no news, no interruptions with whatever I want to think about when I drive along. And it really is great to have that silent time. I had the home box office pulled out of my house. I've had a year and several months, and the only movie I saw in about 15 months was Daniel. The rest I would see the beginning and think they were horrible and turn them off. They were boring compared to what I had to do here that was more interesting. So I cut all of those things out, and my head is much clearer, and I can do more writing and not have that input that we think we need, all this news analysis and talk shows and things that are going on around us that you really don't need if you want to be creative or do any kind of writing or serious putting together of material that is of interest instead of being interrupted, these intrusions of the media coming into your life. And then the fourth thing was that as of January the 1st, I gave up sugar. I've been a vegetarian for over 6 years, but I kicked the sugar habit, really a sugar freak. A subscriber to these broadcasts sent me the book Sugar Blues. I'd never read it. I knew about it, but didn't want to know it. And I just decided cold turkey that nothing that has sugar in it, I wouldn't have any part of it or taste of it. I didn't know how I'd survive. I'm doing better than ever and working harder than ever and having more fun. And I don't know if all this will work for you, but I finally think I'm in control of my own self in a way that was getting out of control, running off to eat the cookies and the cakes and baking and the candies and out at the bakeries and socializing, eating the sweets. I feel a lot better for it, and also I have time in my brain without a lot of the news coming in. And it does take that quiet time to absorb a lot of material and books. A lot of good information is coming out by various serious researchers, and there's no way you can mingle it with this constant talk show interview kind of news, which is non-news, that will fill your brain. Now, there's an article just this morning in the San Francisco Chronicle, a syndicated story by Richard Reeves, very pertinent to the things that I've been trying to do or the way I feel about events. And he brought up the story of Frank Sinatra at the inaugural, and that when he met Barbara Howard, the reporter of Entertainment Tonight, H-O-W-A-R, that Sinatra walked up to her and said, "You're dead. Every one of you, you're all dead." Now, I read that he had said that, and I didn't understand what there was that caused him to say it, except that Sinatra used to have a lot of temper tantrums and goon squads and beat people up. He was a notorious person for anger and fits of anger and putting them on other people, physical, not just verbal. But this is at the inaugural ball, and it was picked up by the various broadcasters and on the microphone. And Reeves went on to say that what made him so mad was a story in the Washington Post about the old Rat Pack that Sinatra and Dean Martin and Sammy Davis and Peter Lawford ganged around together, went together, and that Sinatra had known a gangster or two, and that the grand jury or two would have liked to have known him better. And he got mad at that, and that was his gripe for the evening. And Richard Reeves says there's a lesson to the tempest of the temperament. And that's the press, like most everything and everyone else in America, doesn't pay enough attention to what they think is stale material. The press calls it stale material. They decide for us. You don't want the past. And he says, in more elegant phrasing, we have no sense of history. We're always paying the price for that. Americans want to live in the present. They don't care much about the past. The first lawsuit in the new state of California included two very important American ones. The statute of limitations was reduced for prosecution of past crimes, and procedures were eased whereby people can change their names. And he said that same attitude applies to bankruptcy laws. It applies to when you meet people at bars. They can be one person for one night. Their names are faked. We get people applying for jobs. The resumes are faked. And people come across imposters as teachers, getting high salaries who aren't supposed to be teachers, and surgeons who aren't surgeons that didn't go to medical school. And he asked the question, why drag up stale material, whether or not somebody actually went to Princeton? He says, in our politics, disdain for the stale stuff allows candidates and public officials regularly to get away with the murder of the truth. And this applies, and I interject to what Richard Reeves says, was the disdain for what you call the stale stuff gets in the way with biographies and autobiographies that publishers put out that do not allow you to have the truth. And he says they frequently get away with murder of the truth, and they also, we know, get away with murder. He says Gary Hart can go along and lie about his age. Senator McCarthy lied about his heroic war record. Nixon lied when he says he's a new Nixon, and he turned out to have the same stale defects as the old. There's a focus on Ronald Reagan as the performer of the day, but they never get into the stale stuff of how he got where he was and how he got his money and what he did during the war. Now, just last week, I was talking about Reagan during the war with the OSS duplicating the bombing of Peenemünde and the rocket scientists, and then being on commissions to cover up the murder of John Kennedy later when Mr. Walter Dornberger and Wernher von Braun were part of the plans and plot to murder John Kennedy. A full cycle there. And Reeves concludes by saying, Sinatra may like it, but the stale material is the real stuff about him, and that's what upsets him so much. So does that give him a right to beat up a woman reporter? What they said about him was true. There wasn't anything untrue about it. And now we get to the stale stuff of CBS filming the Errol Flynn biography. Doris Keating bought the book, the rights to Errol Flynn's biography 8 years ago. Her father, Barry Mahon, M-E-H-O-N, was Flynn's business manager. The family lived next door to the actor in Rome and in Tangier. And she was very close to him, and she wanted to write about his life in Hollywood, which is her prerogative. A few years later, just after she bought the rights to the movie, Charles Higham came out with his book on Errol Flynn and his Nazi connections to Dr. Urban, who was a close friend of Errol Flynn's. And so what they did in the movie, they changed his name. Instead of being Dr. Urban of the Gestapo, they gave him an Irish name, and the Dutch doctor was given this cute Irish name so that you wouldn't recognize him as being in the Gestapo if that name is in history books. So they make him in the movie a humanitarian and a rustabout. And according to the Flynn biographer, this Dr. Urban, he was an Austrian-born doctor who became a United States citizen in 1930. This is Charles Higham's book. He was suspected of being a Nazi spy during the 30s, and his citizenship was revoked in 1951 for reasons of national security. Now, I don't fault her for making a movie on his days in Hollywood, but what is the problem is by leaving out the name of his friend. When they wanted Olivia de Havilland in the film with him, they didn't call her Doris something else and make up fictitious names. The names of the other people were real, but the member of the Gestapo was changed. If Flynn was all the things he was to her, just leave the name in. People have written about Mrs. Borman and Mrs. Goebbels or Mrs. Goering. If you love the Nazi or he's a friend of yours and he's so fascinating to you, don't admit you don't like him, but what are you hiding when you leave it out? There's another book coming out about Dr. Urban by a Mr. Strober, S-T-R-O-I-B-E-R. He completed a book called Alibi, a biography of Dr. Urban, and he wrote to CBS that hiding the true identity of one particular character in a docudrama in which all other major characters are called by their correct names, is not only misleading millions of TV viewers into thinking Flynn's best friend is a harmless eccentric, but it debases the memory of those who suffered under Nazism. This is an article from the New York Times, January the 16th, by Stephen Farber. Paul Bigrow, the vice president of CBS program, responded to Mr. Strober. He said, "The film we're presenting is an autobiography, a common accepted literary and dramatic form on Errol Flynn, which is all right. But the accusation they're saying is, if you're going to have the character in it all, have him in it. Because Mr. Higham, in his biography, The Untold Story, published by Doubleday, made a variety of accusations about Flynn's involvement with Nazis, with the Nazi Party, papers from the State Department, the FBI, the suspected espionage of Dr. Urban, Dr. Urban's working with Errol Flynn and correspondence with him that reflects Flynn's pro-Nazi sympathies and his anti-Semitic remarks. And the filmmakers knew enough about Errol Flynn and Dr. Urban to leave Urban's name out of the film. So therefore, CBS are protecting the Nazis." Charles Higham had said that the FBI kept files for many years at that time, and Flynn's notoriety, his sexual notoriety, contributed to that, and they wanted to make him out apolitical, the point is, in the film. But Flynn and Urban together were not apolitical animals, so leave Urban out altogether, or don't give him another name in the film to deceive people. Now, the comment of CBS News, according to the producers, their position was, "We thought it would be boring to deal with politics." Don Taylor was the director. Steve Mills, the production vice president. Now, you might want to write those names down and write to CBS, to Don Taylor, or to Steve Mills, the vice president of the production, because their idea is to steer clear of political controversy. No, they're protecting Errol Flynn. It's nothing to do with the production at all. The controversy comes later. Let them make the film of whatever they want. If he's got this friend and he's so nice to him, put him in there and let the cookies crumble wherever they fall. CBS says, no, you'll be bored. You don't want to deal with politics. Now, that's the same mentality that Richard Rees was talking about in the paper today, that the past is boring. We'll show you our version today of Flynn, and we can make up any name we want if his politics stunk to high heaven, and there's absolute proof that he, too, was a Nazi. Now, there's been a lot of talk in the news about Senator Jesse Helms trying to get a consortium from North Carolina to buy up CBS. The group Fairness in Media are working with that, and one of their targets is Dan Rather. They want to get that CBS anchorman, that liberal Dan Rather. In the memo, it says, "That's not what the free press means to me." Well, I never thought I would agree with Jesse Helms on any subject, but I don't think Dan Rather represents the free press either. Now, I make a suggestion to Dan Rather if he wants to defend himself against the planned takeover. Dan Rather was in Dallas, Texas. He accompanied the shooting of John Kennedy with the famous remarks that Penn Jones inserted into the Zapruder film showing John Kennedy's head blown off. When the head was going backward to show that the bullet came from the front, based on a nice law of physics, and the head is thrown back, Dan Rather made the television version and the video version that Kennedy's fatal shot, his head goes forward. And in the film, if you've seen it, he plays this over and over. The head goes forward. That's Dan Rather telling you that the fatal shot came from behind the head when the fatal shot of John Kennedy came from the front to the back. Now, Dan Rather has lied on this point for 22 years. And being the good boy of CBS and carrying the lie for all these years, what does it get him? He's called a liberal. There's one way to get to Jesse Helms. He could contact me, and I would give him the James Frankenberry affidavits and remarks that the plan to kill John Kennedy was done in Jesse Helms' backyard at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. And Mr. Frankenberry became aware of it when several defendants in the Watergate case were down recruiting people for the shooting team that would go to General Walker's house that was blamed later on Lee Harvey Oswald and didn't touch Walker and would shoot John Kennedy, they thought they were practicing to murder a foreign dignitary, practicing in the United States at Fort Bragg to kill a foreign dignitary. But then he found out it was John Kennedy recognizing the Watergate team. Now, Frank Sturgis wasn't always Frank Sturgis. He was Frank Fiorino, and he worked in disinformation with the Schlumberger, the Double Check Organization, the Anti-Castro Cubans, and Lee Harvey Oswald with that can of worms during the Watergate times. And this man recognized several people, defendants, in the Watergate case, recruiting and working with the marksmen at North Carolina. And this is the Jesse Helms territory, his close affiliation not only to Mr. Daubuisson and the death squads currently in El Salvador, but to the German Nazis that formed the special forces in his hometown of North Carolina, his home state. So I suggest if Dan Rather wanted to be heroic at this time where there are no heroes, he could come forward and challenge Jesse Helms to open up the investigation of the Kennedy assassination and the crossfire and the fatal shot coming out of North Carolina. That would be a little bit closer to the truth. I want to just bring up a few items just for a moment, and then a great deal on the Howard Hughes case because of the new book that just came out in Howard Hughes, and I've been inundated with telephone calls to talk about the Howard Hughes because of the work I've done on that. But there are a few other items that I did want to bring up to you before I get to that. One is that Kathy Evelyn Smith has returned from Canada for an arraignment in regards to the John Belushi murder. And she was showed up at her press conference and was on the NBC Today show with Howard Weitzman, her attorney. In case you don't know it, remember it, Weitzman was the gentleman who got John DeLorean off the hook with that drug deal when DeLorean was directly linked to large narcotic traffickers and down to Klaus Barbie in Bolivia before he was arrested. Weitzman graduated from the University of Southern California. He went to law school. He represented Mary Bruner, a disciple of the Charles Manson case, another CIA Defense Department case out of the LAPD, and won her acquittal on murder. He got DeLorean's acquittal. She still sends Christmas cards. This was a report in the newspaper at the time of the DeLorean trial called The Howard and Don Show. Those are the two reporters that carried DeLorean. It's from the LA Times. Mr. Weitzman represented Tom Dragna, one of the five reputed mobsters on racketeering and murder charges. He was convicted of two counts and cleared of the murder charges. He had a major setback with Grandma Mafia, Barbara Muzin, who was charged and sent with 25 years in prison. And he's been helping the DeLorean. He helped the DeLorean case get off. And he made a threat right on television on NBC that if Kathy were charged in this case for any major crime or had to go to trial, he would bring in all the people that she dealt narcotics with in Los Angeles. And one of the sources I was told was the brother of Daryl Gates of the Los Angeles Police Department. January the 24th, 1985, the San Jose Mercury has a quote from the former Los Angeles County District Attorney Robert Filibosian. And he said Wednesday that he had forbid his prosecutors to plea bargain with Kathy Smith at all. I had given clearly free policy directions, not to do any plea bargaining in this case. He says that case was not a manslaughter. It was not a manslaughter. It's a murder case. And be sure with Mr. Howard Weitzman and what he knows about crime and the Los Angeles Police Department and the links also to the higher-ups in that city. The Johnny Carson cocaine connections are, I know, linked to Kathy Smith and the Belushi demise. If somebody would follow that through the way I've studied it, they're just about a hair's breadth away from each other. Now, one of the people that went to see John Belushi, Leslie Marks, her name is, testified to the grand jury that he looked very tired and distraught. He was pale, he was coughing, choking noises in his sleep the day before, and his arms were red with these needles. Can't anybody in that city call 911? I've asked that before. I mean, doesn't anybody have a finger that calls the emergency and says, get this guy to a hospital? There's two criteria for incarcerating somebody. It doesn't matter if they're rich or poor, famous, infamous, the world's richest like Howard Hughes, or the poorest. This is a controversial man making movies about politicians and the FBI and the mafia wineries. A brilliant man opposing our position in El Salvador. A very political person making caricatures of the great Henry Kissinger on Saturday Night Live and a lot of other public officials, Barbara Wawa and all of them. You take your little finger in case you're ever in this position. You dial 911 and you get emergency. If a person is a danger to somebody else or a danger to themselves, even if they voluntarily want to do it, you can have them committed at least 72 hours and 2 weeks on to save their life where he could get back to his wife in New York. How do these people have the nerve to stream through that hotel room and testify that he is sick? And remember that this Kathy left the place after he was dead and went out and had breakfast and then comes back with paraphernalia. This is horrendous, and as long as this thing is allowed to happen, it will happen over and over and over again. It's a disgusting story. John Belushi was, I happen to be very fond of him and watch Saturday Night Live continuously, and I think he was a genius, and I know he was murdered. I did broadcast on it, and these people literally get away with murder over and over again. Now, another team that gets away with murder is the Soldier of Fortune Group. Mr. Robert Brown, who publishes it, the protege of John Singlaub, the famous board member of Western Goals, head of the World Anti-Communist League, working out of Taiwan with Nazis and death squads all over the world to keep a handful of people controlling the resources of the world. The story this week, the Soldier of Fortune magazine reprints the CIA Contra manual. When the CIA is put on the fire and Mr. Casey, the protege of William Donovan, has said you can't tell them how to kill judges and public officials, and how to sabotage countries and your psychological warfare of carrying on your guerrilla warfare down there in Nicaragua or with the bosses in El Salvador to keep the hands property in the hands of a few for whatever reasons. And now the Contras are murdering in Honduras, death squads in Honduras, just like they've done through this whole area. When the CIA has said they can't do it, then along comes Mr. Brown, who works with Singlaub. Singlaub is up at the National Security Council, the Defense Department, and was behind the getting out of these magazines, these dangerous mercenary magazines that are the government. They've become the extension of what our government is. If Congress votes that we can't do a certain thing, then they do it. And I have a lot more to put on the air about that and will. But this week, the Soldier of Fortune magazine reprinted the manual. I have a copy of the manual. It refers to Christian soldiers, to everything there is Christian. They take Jewish money from Israel to help the Contras, and the Jewish money from Israel has always been strong with the Somozas. It's been a love affair, vice versa. They don't mind that or the Jewish weapons they take, but it's a Christian war for Christ, and the idea that Soldier of Fortune is not put on the carpet or put out of business because what they do at Congress isn't allowed, telling them they can't do, is showing that invisible government as a visible alternative. Whatever the men in Washington are voted to say or do, it is negated by a handful of people who then go ahead and do it anyway, and you call that freedom of speech. Now, we haven't heard much about Donovan's trial recently. I just wanted to quickly read something that was sent to me from The Nation magazine. A researcher in Florida, David Miller, sends me a lot of good articles. He's a writer. And he sent me one February 28th, 1981, Something Rotten in New Jersey. 1981 was right after Ronald Reagan was in and Raymond Donovan was selected as Secretary of Labor, right after those hearings, immediately. And The Nation magazine said the FBI's pre-confirmation investigation of Donovan turned up 18 specific allegations of wrongdoings of him and the Schiavone Construction Company. The most damaging charges were those made by the FBI informant Ralph Picardo. Remember his relationship to the Hoffa murder, who said Donovan personally met with him 20 times in 1967 and 68, gave him payments from Schiavone. Funds were never delivered to construction sites that were never made, and these were obviously payoffs. Orrin Hatch, the righteous Mormon senator from Utah, chairman of the Senate Labor and Human Resources Committee, said the FBI made a mistake and pushed the Donovan confirmation through. They made a mistake, but he was on a committee that approved of the Donovan passage as Secretary of Labor. And the article goes into the Washington Legal Foundation that had a petition set up for Donovan. The Foundation's National Advisory Board is a who's who of the new right, among them the then-living Larry McDonald, the Georgia's congressman, the card-carrying member, the head of the John Birch Society, and also on the advisory board is Orrin Hatch of Utah, who spearheaded the defeat of the AFL-CIO unions reform, the labor reform, and who was one who shepherded Donovan's confirmation through Labor and Human Resources Committee. He was on the board of the group pushing for Donovan. On the surface, he blamed the FBI for running it through, but on the side, he was always for Donovan, Orrin Hatch, and he's on an anti-drug committee with Daniel Graham, which is a farce, when Donovan and the mafia are very much part and parcel of the entire drug problem. Also, People's World had a story October the 2nd, 1984, that I didn't have on the air, didn't have time, on Donovan as a member, one of the early members of the Young Americans for Freedom. Now, this is Ronald Reagan and Charles Willoughby and Robert Morris and William Buckley. And that can of worms from up in Sharon, Connecticut, down to Texas, and with prominent warriors, future Cold Warriors on the board. This article says that Donovan was with Ronald Reagan and a number of high-level government people on the National Advisory Board of the right-wing group Young Americans for Freedom. It was formed in 1960. The YAF had had support for General Key of South Vietnam, who they were founded in 1960. Now, Key is one of the big drug dealers in Orange County at the present time, and Key's group are involved in the murder of a professor who's been fighting in for freedom in Vietnam. They call him a communist. Key's has a death squad in this state, a drug group in this state, and he's living right now near San Clemente, the home where Ronald Reagan used to live, out in that territory, San Clemente. But they were fighting hard and protecting Premier Key, who admired Adolf Hitler, and is William Donovan, Raymond Donovan, rather, not William, that's the OSS, Raymond Donovan, was an early member of this committee of who's who, Adolf Manjou in the far right wing. Now, since he's been the Secretary of Labor, he's reduced the requirements for the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. He has cut down the funds for the committee, largest cutbacks from the Labor Committee of any group that have been in Congress or any cabinet position, cut the budget of $45 billion just last year. When this was written in 1983, the department was second to none in contribution to the initial budget cut of $45 billion. And we contributed $9 billion of the initial cut. Out of the $45 was the labor group. Well, Donovan was one of the early Reagan, William Buckley, the Knights of Malta, Robert Morris, and that gang. Far right-wing mentality put in charge of labor, which is exactly the kind of appointments Reagan's been making across the board. Recently, there have been some horrible ones. I haven't updated the Reagan appointments, but I'll get to that. There was just a small article noticing in the newspaper. This was last October. Somebody wrote in, isn't that Ray Donovan having next to him Bill Bittman, his attorney, who was the unindicted co-conspirator in a Watergate cover-up, handing vast sums of cash to E. Howard Hunt from Bittman and trying to get them to plead guilty. Yeah, that was the bag man. We've talked about William Bittman before. He's also the attorney for Edwin Wilson of the CIA and his nefarious dealings. So the background of Raymond Donovan, I just wanted to bring out not only to the YAF, but to Orrin Hatch and the committee that pressured to get Donovan through, knowing that the FBI had information on him and his links to organized crime. The Donovan investigation is still going on. The trial hasn't started yet, of course, and he's still Secretary of Labor. Ronald Reagan refuses to have him step down as Secretary of Labor. Another one of my favorite cases is in the news this week again. They keep resurrecting. The ones that I've done stories on all through the years are never-ending stories. If they had an end, I wouldn't have to be doing them. They're open cases, and that's why I do them and keep updating them. And that's the story of Joseph Mengele and the new reports that Canada may have had him and that he may have been in the custody of the American Army at the time he left Europe and went to South America. Joseph Mengele is an interesting person for lots of reasons. The parts about Auschwitz, you know, but his role after the war and his experimentation with Paraguayan Indians and medical genocide continued after the war, and he had links to the United States of intelligence all along. We'll take 1 minute break and get back to Joseph Mengele's and then Howard Hughes, and there isn't much difference between the two, or you might ask about the Hughes Medical Center and the relationship to Joseph Mengele.